director of the National Center for Neighborhood Enterprise. He's one of the innovative thinkers about how to best help people help themselves in America, to make sure that hope extends to all neighborhoods, not just some neighborhoods, but every neighborhood in our country. I appreciate Rodney Carroll, who's the president and CEO of the Welfare to Work Partnership. His job has been to gather up people who are willing to help people go from welfare to work, and he's done a magnificent job. I remember well our meeting in Chicago with the Big Brown, UPS, which is one of the leading companies in America to helping people find the dignity of work. And we sat there on the stage and heard the stories of those who have gone from welfare to work. It must have made you feel good, Rodney, because you had a lot to do with helping these individuals. And so thanks for coming. John Gregory is the president of TEACH, the Enrichment Association of Community Healing. I appreciate John being here and all the rest of you for coming. Welcome. Glad you're here. The reforms of the 1990s recognized that people on welfare are not charges of the state. They're citizens of this country with abilities and aspirations. Both parties in Congress realized that welfare system as we knew it sapped the soul and drained the spirit from our citizens. They came together, the people of both parties, to put an end to the culture of dependency that welfare had created. The obligation of government did not end with just mailing of a check, and that's important for our citizens to realize. Men and women deserved a chance to learn new skills. That was an obligation of government, to help people learn, to use their talents so that they could realize dreams, to gain the fulfillment of sense of purpose that comes with striving and working and providing for their own families. In the 7 years since welfare was reformed, millions of Americans have shared in this experience. Their lives and our country are better off. Today, more than 2 million fewer families are on welfare, 2 million fewer than in 1996. It's a reduction of 54%. That's a number, but behind each number is a life. And that's important to recognize. In Washington, we spend a lot of time talking about numbers. And that's okay. It's kind of a measuring tool. But we've also got to remember with each number is somebody's aspiration and hope. During the period from 1996 to 2001, the percentage of welfare recipients who are working tripled. That's incredibly positive news. According to the most recent census data, the poverty rate amongst Hispanic children has reached the lowest level in over 20 years. The poverty rate among African-American children is the lowest ever recorded. There's a correlation, it seems like to me. Behind these statistics are great personal achievements, adversity that have been overcome, and lives have changed forever. I've met people all around our country who can share their stories of hard work and fighting odds that have been stacked against them. Moms and dads who have battled addiction and have overcome addiction. Folks who have had trouble holding a job and then found out that they could and realized their dreams. The welfare law is a success because it puts government on the side of personal responsibility and has helped people change their lives for the better. Help people realize their dreams. Help people help themselves. That's the key aspect of one of the key principles of the law that makes a lot of sense, that has helped make this law effective. Last year, the House of Representatives passed legislation to build on the successes of the 1996 welfare reform law. They did so because they want more Americans to know the pride and success that come from hard work. The law passed the House, that passed the House, would require 40 hours of work each week. There was a serious requirement for work. Of the 40 hours, 16 of those could be used for job training or education, and when needed, treatment for addiction. In other words, the 40 hours of work was a part of that 40 hours was helping people help themselves. And that's an important aspect of any law that encourages people to go from welfare to work. The House bill set an ambitious goal for states to have 70% of the welfare recipients working within a 5-year period of time. We encourage them to think that way because we believe in setting a high bar. We believe in the best. We don't accept mediocrity. Some say it's asking too much. But a lot of those voices were the same ones that said the 1996 law was flawed. Or they had low expectations for what is possible in this society. Skepticism is refuted every single day, however, when we meet the hard-won successes from former welfare recipients. That's the best case that we can make, those of us who believe in expecting the best and working hard to achieve the best. We've got new data this month refuting skepticism as well. A study from the University of Michigan shows that in states with the strongest work incentives, single parents have seen larger increases in income than in states with weaker work requirements. Work is the key to success in helping families lift themselves out of poverty. It's the key to success for improving the lives of our children. And the strong incentives in the House bill will encourage work. Fortunately, the Senate never was able to act on the House bill. So it's died. Today, I want to remind the new Congress we have an obligation to reauthorize the welfare bill, welfare reform, to make it work. And so calling upon both houses to get after it. Let's get a new bill up, a bill that that in which the House and the Senate have got to work closely to achieve the objectives that we have just set out, the idea of getting people to work, make them less dependent upon government, to help people in need, so they can realize their dreams. I also want Congress to provide $17 billion a year to help the states run their welfare programs and $4.8 billion a year to help pay for child care, which is a funding obligation that goes with the idea of setting high goals, high standards and strong goals. And since the caseloads have fallen by half, the states will now have twice the resources to spend on welfare and job training and child care. See, back in 1996, they were spending $7,000 per family to help people get to work. Under this budget request, the expenditure will be $16,000 per family. $7,000 was good enough in 1996. It seems like $16,000 is good enough into 2003 to help people get ahead. It's important for Congress to authorize funding not just for next year, but for the next 5 years, so that people who are working to help people understand there's a steady stream of funds that will help with the planning. It's also important for Congress to work with us to get a faith-based initiative going. I did a lot through an executive order the other day that said faith programs will not be discriminated against at the federal level. But the faith-based initiative is a part of welfare reform. It's one thing to help a person get the job skills necessary. But a lot of times we need to help people with their hearts and their souls, and the only place to find that help is in the faith-based community. And so therefore, I'm still going to stay strong on the faith-based initiative, because I know of the hope and promise found in our churches and synagogues and mosques, hope and promise that can't be duplicated at the federal level. And as we encourage work in welfare, we've also got to encourage growth in our economy. I'm aware of that. And that's why I introduced a plan to build on the economic momentum we have going for us. We've come out of recession. The enemy hit us, and that hurt our economy. We had a few of our corporate citizens thought they could fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. So there was a kind of startled our investor class, and American people were shocked by the fact that too many citizens weren't telling the truth. So I signed a law that's going to hold people to account, and we're after them. For those who've cooked the books, there's going to be a consequence. We're regaining the confidence in the numbers now being put forth. We're slowly but surely coming out of the three hits to our economy, and we need to do more. And that's why I've argued that the more people have in their pocket, the more they're likely to spend. And when they spend money, it's more likely to provide jobs for people. It's the strength of our economy, and it's important for Congress to work with me to encourage consumers to have more money, investors to have more money, to take care of the aged in their retirement, and the plans I laid out. Recognize that the money we spend here isn't the government's money, it's the people's money, and the more money the people have in their pocket, the more likely this economy is going to grow. And as the economy grows, it's more likely we're going to have success at helping people. And the other thing we can do is to do a better job for unemployed Americans through what I call reemployment accounts. These accounts will provide up to $3,000 per person to help pay for training, child care, moving expenses, or other costs of finding a job. It provides incentive for people who are looking for work. If you find a job before the $3,000 runs out, then you get to keep the remainder, the balance. In other words, it's additional money to help people find work. It's money on top of the current system. It's money that that will recognize that, you know, power is best when it's dispersed to the people we're trying to help. It'll help states on the front lines of where there's unemployment or chronic unemployment. It's a good idea. I hope Congress acts as quickly as possible. I mean, the idea is that we want to help people. That's what we want to do in America. We want to help people who, in this land of plenty, have overcome some incredibly tough times because of the lack of things. Sometimes the lack of love.
Been watching President Bush in the East Room of the White House talking about welfare reform. We'll continue to follow his remarks. There is a developing story out of France. The Sacré-Cœur Church in Paris has been evacuated now, officials tell us, because there has been, they say, a homemade explosive device. You're seeing a picture of it right now from a website. A homemade explosive device found inside the building. It is one of France's most visited tourist attractions. 8 million visitors there last year. And a tourist apparently found this homemade explosive device inside the Sacré-Cœur Church, which overlooks Paris today. It is now evacuated, and a bomb team is on the scene investigating. We will continue to follow that story as well. Buchanan and Press is coming up next. I'm Sam Shane. I'll join you back here tomorrow. We hope to see you then. You're watching MSNBC, America's News Channel.
Hi. I have to get copy your laser and inkjet paper sizes A3, A4, toner, printer ink, letter size envelopes, legal envelopes, padded shipping envelopes, memo pads, legal pads.
I'm sick and tired of games and deception.
Now, this comes over the past couple of days. We've heard statements from today from Kofi Annan, the chief of the UN, and the chief weapons inspector at the UN, Hans Blix, urging patience, urging more time for the inspectors to do their job in Iraq, perhaps even until March, certainly that they need.
President's overall leadership still wins rave reviews. That's a quick look at the headlines. Talk Back Live with Arthel Neville is up next.
Ever since the Republicans took this base, and I helped work on that strategy for Nixon, Republicans won 5 out of 6 presidential elections, and one of the reasons, perception, the Democratic Party cannot stand up and say no to Jesse Jackson. That has been a major problem of theirs. It's why Republicans have suddenly been winning landslides in America when, under the New Deal, they could only win with Dwight David Eisenhower.
Look. Hey, Lester, George Bush knows he can't win with just the white vote. He says he's reaching out to minorities, but I'll tell you what they're going to say after today. If he says what Associated Press just reports, they're going to say, you talk, but when push comes to shove, the Southern strategy that Pat helped design still lives, and you always come down on the side of the white males.
I'm told we're about a minute away now from the president coming out of the Roosevelt Room. And just to quickly set again the stage, the Supreme Court is weighing the race-based admission policies at the University of Michigan. Under their undergraduate programs, they essentially award extra points to minority candidates at the law school. They use race as one of several factors that could help someone during the application process. It's been challenged. Lawsuits brought by 3 white students. This is being characterized as the biggest affirmative action case we have seen in a generation. And in just a moment, the President of the United States is going to come out, weigh in on this. Apparently, according to senior administration officials being quoted by Associated Press, the President will say that race-based admission is unconstitutional. Here now is the President of the United States.
Good afternoon. The Supreme Court will soon hear arguments in a case about admissions policies and student diversity in public universities. I strongly support diversity of all kinds, including racial diversity, and higher education. But the method used by the University of Michigan to achieve this important goal is fundamentally flawed. At their core, the Michigan policies amount to a quota system that unfairly rewards or penalizes prospective students based solely on their race. So tomorrow, my administration will file a brief with the court arguing that the University of Michigan's admissions policies, which award students a significant number of extra points based solely on their race, and establishes numerical targets for incoming minority students, are unconstitutional. Our Constitution makes it clear that people of all races must be treated equally under the law. Yet we know that our society has not fully achieved that ideal. Racial prejudice is a reality in America. It hurts many of our citizens. As a nation, as a government, and as individuals, we must be vigilant in responding to prejudice wherever we find it. Yet as we work to address the wrong of racial prejudice, we must not use means that create another wrong and thus perpetuate our divisions. America is a diverse country, racially, economically, and ethnically. And our institutions of higher education should reflect our diversity. A college education should teach respect and understanding and goodwill. And these values are strengthened when students live and learn with people from many backgrounds. Yet quota systems that use race to include or exclude people from higher education and the opportunities it offers are divisive, unfair, and impossible to square with the Constitution. In the programs under review by the Supreme Court, the University of Michigan has established an admissions process based on race. At the undergraduate level, African American students and some Hispanic students and Native American students receive 20 points out of a maximum 150, not because of any academic achievement or life experience, but solely because they are African American, Hispanic, or Native American. To put this in perspective, a perfect SAT score is worth only 12 points in the Michigan system. Students who accumulate 100 points are generally admitted. So those 20 points awarded solely based on race are often the decisive factor. At the law school, some minority students are admitted to meet percentage targets, while other applicants with higher grades and better scores are passed over. This means that students are being selected or rejected based primarily on the color of their skin. The motivation for such an admissions policy may be very good, but its result is discrimination, and that discrimination is wrong. Some states are using innovative ways to diversify their student bodies. Recent history has proven that diversity can be achieved without using quotas. Systems in California and Florida and Texas have proven that by guaranteeing admissions to the top students from high schools throughout the state, including low-income neighborhoods, colleges can attain broad racial diversity. In these states, race-neutral admissions policies have resulted in levels of minority attendance for incoming students that are close to, and in some instances slightly surpass, those under the old race-based approach. We should not be satisfied with the current numbers of minorities on Americans' college campuses. Much progress has been made. Much more is needed. University officials have the responsibility and the obligation to make a serious, effective effort to reach out to students from all walks of life without falling back on unconstitutional quotas. Schools should seek diversity by considering a broad range of factors in admissions, including a student's potential and life experiences. Our government must work to make college more affordable for students who come from economically disadvantaged homes. And because we're committed to racial justice, we must make sure that America's public schools offer a quality education to every child from every background, which is the central purpose of the education reforms I signed last year. America's long experience with the segregation we have put behind us and the racial discrimination we still struggle to overcome requires a special effort to make real the promise of equal opportunity for all. My administration will continue to actively promote diversity and opportunity in every way that the law permits. Thank you very much.